science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
That's right. It is time for our favourite segment. We've got AUT's Alan Blackman in the studio. How are you going, Alan?
I'm doing very well. Well, how are you?
Well.
Yeah.
Great. It's great to hear as always. Yeah. First up, we have a story about an interstellar game of Where's Wally? Well, not really, but astronomers have discovered half of the missing matter in the universe. I read this title and immediately had an existential crisis, as you would. Please, Alan, tell me how there is missing matter in the universe, because to me that makes no sense.
Well, okay, so it all goes back to the Big Bang. And we all know about the Big Bang. And so everything just sort of came into existence with the Big Bang. And what the Big Bang made basically were three things. So it made stars, or planets, I guess, and it made truckloads of gas. And it also made this mysterious dark matter, or dark energy, as it's also called. So they've done analysis of essentially the Big Bang and the energy that came out of that. And from that analysis, they figure out that there's a whole lot of matter missing that we just can't see, okay? So we can certainly see stars, we can see the planets, and we can see these big balls of gas and stuff like that. But
can we see dark matter, or is that
the whole point? No, that's the whole point. So we can't see this dark matter. So if you add up all of the stuff that you can see, excuse me, that comes about to sort of 10% of the matter that should be in the universe based on what happened in the Big Bang. So to make up for this, people are saying that there's this so-called dark matter, and they call it dark matter because obviously we can't see it. And the reason, or the proposed reason why we can't see it, is that it's at the wrong temperature. Okay, so very, very hot things give out X-rays, and we can see X-rays, okay?
Yeah.
Very, very cold things absorb light when light goes through them, okay? So we can figure out what's sort of behind them from the amount of light that's been absorbed.
Okay.
But stuff, this dark matter, which is at a particular temperature, which is about 1,000,000 degrees Celsius, which does sound rather hot, but
Not hot enough, really isn't,
yeah. So that's at a temperature where we can't actually see it. We can't see it sort of emitting any radiation. We can't see it absorbing any radiation. And so it kind of acts like it's not there. We just physically can't see it. So what people are thinking, or what people have thought, I guess, over time, is that that this dark matter is very probably sort of between all the galaxies. Okay, so there's a lot of matter in galaxies, and they think that this dark matter is in between the galaxies, and they call this region the warm, hot intergalactic medium, which has got the very nice acronym, the WHIM. The WHIM. And so they have been sort of looking for evidence of this WHIM. And so last week there was a paper published by some folk in Scotland and France, basically providing evidence for the WHIM. Okay. And that could be the start of identifying this dark matter. So the way that they found that, as I said before, when light passes through things, when light passes through things, it can get absorbed, and we can't see that because of the fact this is the wrong temperature. But what we can see is the light that gets scattered. So when light passes through a gas or whatever, it can also be scattered as well.
Okay.
And so they've done some very high level calculations and observations, et cetera, et cetera. And basically what they're saying is that they can now probably account for around about 30% of the missing matter in the universe.
Oh, so it's not half.
No, it's not half. Okay. No. The article was rather misleading, yes indeed.
As per usual.
So, and they did this independently, the two groups, so the group in Scotland, the group in France, and they came out with roughly about the same answer, which is always good for these sorts of things. So,
yes.
So it may be that we are on our way to finding all of this missing matter in the universe.
I have two questions.
Oh, dear.
Here we go.
Oh, dear.
Okay, so firstly, how do we know how much matter is in the universe, and how do we quantify what percentage we've found of the missing matter if we can't see the missing matter? How do we know it's there?
Okay, it all comes back to analysis of the energy that must have been released in the Big Bang. Okay, so this happened about 13 billion or so years ago, I think, the Big Bang, and there are still traces of the radiation from the Big Bang out in space today, because, you know, space is always expanding.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can actually see the remnants of this radiation, and it exists at a temperature about, I think, about 2.7 Kelvin or something like that, about 2.7 degrees above absolute zero, and you can actually see this. And then you can go and do some calculations if you're a physicist, and from that, and base it the size of the observable universe, you can then work backwards and figure out just how much energy must have been let go in the Big Bang. And as good old Einstein said, E equals MC squared. So yep. energy and matter are interconvertible.
Okay.
And away you go from that, basically. So you can figure out how much energy slash matter, because they are the same thing, this should be in the universe. And essentially based on observation. So, you know, just looking at the numbers of stars, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that you can see in the gas clouds, et cetera, et cetera, you can then figure out how much all that, you know, adds up to, and then you subtract the two, and then you find that there's an imbalance. So that's all the missing matter, and that's the dark matter.
Science is awesome. Every time we have this segment, I just go, yeah, science is awesome. You never lie, Alan. Now, if you feel pretty small and meaningless after that last story, you're going to love this one. The story begins with this sentence. The collision of a pair of neutron stars marked by ripples through the fabric of space-time and a flash brighter than a billion suns has been witnessed for the first time in the most intensely observed astronomical event to date. Alan, please help me repair my brain on this one and tell me what that means, because I honestly can't even begin.
Okay, well, this is absolutely fantastic stuff. So you may remember a couple of weeks ago we talked about the Nobel Prize in Physics, and that was given to gravitational waves. So we were talking about big long interferometers and things like that, and how they can basically detect ripples in space-time. That's what they're there for, okay? And so there was a really, really nice example of this in August, in fact, on 17th of August, and it's just been published, and so this is very, very quick for a publication, so it's very, very important stuff. But the guts of this is that they simultaneously, essentially, observed gravitational waves and, I guess, by eye and by infrared and by ultraviolet, also the same event, okay? And this event was, as you said, the collision of two neutron stars.
Okay.
So neutron stars are pretty much about the densest matter that you can get, okay? They come from supernova. So a supernova is when a star gets basically too big for itself, it collapses in under its own gravity, gives out truckloads of energy, et cetera, et cetera, ends up as a neutron star, okay?
Okay.
So a neutron star is so dense that if you take a teaspoon of a neutron star, it will weigh 10 billion tons.
Okay.
Okay? So
yep.
What that's basically saying is that all the nuclei in the atoms are basically hard up against each other, essentially. Mm-hmm. Okay, there's normally a lot of space in atoms, but this thing's so dense that they're just crushed, they're compressed.
Okay.
And so roughly, neutron stars, they're thought to be around about sort of 10 to 20 kilometers in diameter, but they've got the mass of our sun, okay? So that's what makes them so dense, okay?
Okay,
so
they're
enormously dense objects. So, and because they've got that much mass in them, they're very, very strong gravitational field as well. So what happened here was that two neutron stars got pretty damn close to each other.
Yeah.
And they started attracting each other, and they started sort of spinning around each other at around about, I think, 3 or 4 times per second. Now, you think of something that's got two things that have got massive.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, they must have massive gravitational pull.
Yeah,
so they
And then once they got really close to each other, they're going at 2,000 times per second. Okay, which just
rotating at 2,000.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Which just boggles the mind. And then the big collision occurred, and.
Yep.
As you can imagine, there's a buttload of energy given out there, and that's what made these space-time ripples, okay? So these ripples were detected as gravitational waves,
yeah.
And they were detected both in the States and in Italy. And from basic, I guess, triangulation, they could figure out what part of the sky the event must have occurred from. And so everyone got their telescopes and pointed at that part of the sky and were looking for basically something that hadn't been there before. And about 11 hours later, they actually saw it. So they saw the point of light.
They detected the gravitational waves before they saw the actual thing happening.
Yes, indeed. Yep, yep.
Ooh,
okay,
what?
So they know that because the gravitational waves are traveling at the speed of light, and also the light's traveling at the speed of light. So had they had the telescopes in the right place at the
right time,
they would have seen it at the same time. It would have been, you know, coincident. But they did very, very well. And so 11 hours later, this thing was still glowing. And so they could see that. And so this is the first time that they've actually managed to do those two things simultaneously. Okay. And this is really, really good evidence for the whole gravitational wave thing. Because you can imagine that, you know, if anything's going to disrupt the fabric of space-time, as it were.
What does that mean? What does that mean when we disrupt the fabric of space-time? Because to me, that sounds like absurd things might happen.
Okay, so you drop a stone in a pond, and you disrupt the fabric of the pond, don't you, essentially? Yeah. So you're getting waves. You're getting three-dimensional
waves.
That's
water in this one's time. Well, I mean,
No, it's space and time. Oh, okay. So it's that fourth dimension that I think we were talking about the other day. Yeah, yeah. So...
of course we have.
So it's basically, gravitational ripples. That's essentially what they are, gravitational waves. And that's the way that gravity can operate.
Okay. And you were saying that they were circling around each other at 2,000 times per second. If they didn't see the thing and only detected it after it actually happened, then how did they know that they spun at that speed? Or
Because they were looking for the gravitational waves. Okay. So they saw those in real time. And also they saw the there was a gamma ray burst as well. So you get gamma rays out at the same time. So analysis of those can tell you how fast these things were spinning. But the really, really, really cool thing about this is that analysis of the light that was given off by this event showed the presence of heavy elements like platinum and gold. Okay, now, talking about first-year physics or first-year chemistry here, where did all the elements come from? Okay, so we've got 118 known elements. Yeah. How were they made? So the majority of elements in the universe are hydrogen and helium. So that's about 99% of all the atoms in the universe are hydrogen and helium. And helium is made through nuclear fusion of hydrogen, okay? And that happens in the core of our sun. That's how our sun keeps going, okay? It uses hydrogen as a fuel. It fuses the nuclei together. That's why it's called nuclear fusion. And that gives you a heavier element, which is helium. And now potentially, if you take helium nuclei and fuse those together, you can make still heavier elements, okay? Yeah. So the next one's lithium and beryllium, et cetera, all of those. But a star the size of our sun can basically only make helium by fusion. And you've got to get very, very, very big stars in order to make heavier elements.
Is that due to gravity, or is that due to
It's just such a difficult process. There's just such a lot of repulsion in the nucleus.
Okay.
So in order to get them to fuse, you see what happens when you fuse nuclei, you get a hydrogen bomb, okay? So that's the amount of energy that essentially you've got to overcome in order to fuse the nuclei together. So you need enormous stars to be able to fuse heavier nuclei, but you can only get up to iron and nickel at that stage, and they are elements 26 and 28. You still have another 118, you know, to go. So how do you get heavy things like gold and platinum and stuff like that? And so it's been proposed that they are formed in supernova that we were talking about before, and also in processes like this where the neutron stars are coming together and colliding, and they found spectral traces or spectral signatures, I guess, for the presence of gold and platinum in the light from this star. So that's wonderful stuff. That might be a Nobel Prize one day, possibly, but it really supports the whole theory of what they call nucleosynthesis, the synthesis of heavier elements.
So up until this point, we just were like, sweet, gold, platinum, not sure where they come from, but they're just there.
Well, it was proposed that was how they formed, but this is experimental observation now.
So and it's proving the hypothesis.
As much as you can do. So, you know, they've done very, very well in that respect.
It's alchemy, isn't it?
Yeah. It is actually. It is alchemy. You're absolutely right. Yes. Yeah. The formation of elements from other elements. Yes.
I wonder if we will ever master fusion on Earth.
Well, there's a plant being built in France at the moment, and that was supposed to actually open this year. They started building it, 10 years ago probably. And that was the plan, was to have it ready and running in 2017, but that's been pushed back. A wee way now, and it's consuming vast amounts of money, and you know, it's an awfully, awfully difficult thing to do because you're generating such incredibly high temperatures in this fusion process. You've got to contain those somehow, and the way that they do contain them is very, very strong magnetic fields. They need highly, highly focused light, so these all these amazingly high energy lasers, and they all need to focus on one point, et cetera, in order to get the temperatures that you. It's just a phenomenal job. If it works, it'd be great, because it would be, despite their setup costs, it would be a relatively cheap, I guess, form of energy, because all you're using is essentially hydrogen as your fuel. So
yeah, so one of the problems is what the energy gradient's so high to get to that stage, and then having to contain it.
Yes, indeed.
That.
Yes. Yeah. So all sorts of scientific problems to be overcome with making fusion a viable energy source. And personally, why not just use the sun, because that's doing the fusion for us, so we should be working on that.
How do you know so many things, Alan?
I wish
give us the secret. This is why you always win the quiz.
We don't always win. We only got second last night.
Boo. This last story is perfect for a quick brain refresh.
Indeed.
After those last stories, we're talking mindfulness. Beautiful, beautiful mindfulness. Now, the story outlines the fact that the hype surrounding the benefits of mindfulness outweigh the actual scientific evidence of this practice.
I think the story here is that nobody actually knows what mindfulness is. Sadly, it's a term that has entered the common lexicon, and even sort of universities offer courses in it and stuff like that.
Sadly.
Though,
right?
Oh, God, no. Published last week in the journal Perspectives on Psychological Science. So they did a survey essentially of researchers, clinicians, and mediators, and they essentially asked them what they understood by this term mindfulness, and they didn't really get consensus on that. So if you're utilizing something that you don't even know what it is, then what's the point, really, would be my question here. So forgive my cynicism and skepticism. Okay. and everything like that, but it's just a term that means obviously different things to different people, and that's not particularly scientific, is it?
Yeah, it is just a term. I mean, like, just to argue this for the sake of arguing it, you could say that there's anecdotal evidence that it does work for people, and people say, yeah, mindfulness, you know, like using whatever people, I don't know. My mum always tells me, she's probably listening now and saying, yeah, be mindful. Mindfulness is key.
There's anecdotal evidence that homeopathy works as well, but, you know.
Well, any listeners out there that are mindfulness or wellness coaches, please.
Oh, I'm sure there's a few. I'd love to hear from you. Give us a text. Give us a text on 5395 or call us on 309-4831.
Fair enough.
You can talk to me or Ruben. Probably not Alan. He's probably going
to
go.
I'm off to give a lecture, yeah. Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Alan. It's been great as always. It's always fantastic.
Thanks,
cheers,
guys. See ya.
That was Dear Science.